Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis to close out the work week for conservatives. And even before we get to the first martini today, we're happy to report that Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Tim Murphy is not going to stay in office and be able to just casually retire at the end of next year. Murphy, of course, has been exposed this week for not only carrying on an extramarital affair, but for being pro-life on policy, but urging his mistress to get an abortion. Turns out she wasn't actually pregnant, but the hypocrisy has been revealed. He said earlier this week he planned to retire. Pretty clear that Speaker Ryan decided that wasn't good enough. So effective October 21st, Tim Murphy will be out of Congress. There will be a special election. He has won the district quite easily in recent years, so hopefully Republicans win the special election and can hang on to that seat in 2018. But let's move on to our official first martini of the day, Jim. And as we have often said, sometimes the good martini has to be, hey, that other party's pretty dysfunctional too. And that's where we stand right now with the Democrats, particularly on the House side. Linda Sanchez is a Democratic congresswoman, a fairly liberal one at that, from Southern California. You may remember her sister Loretta was in the House along with her for many years. She is no longer there because she ran for Senate and got defeated by Kamala Harris last year. But Linda Sanchez was on C-SPAN, and they were talking about leadership. And then one of the panelists there asked whether she would support the current leadership if the Democrats won the House back next year.
Well, I personally think that, you know, our leadership does a tremendous job, but I do think we have this real breadth and depth of talent within our caucus. And I do think it's time to pass the torch to a new generation of leaders. And I want to be a part of that transition. I want to see that happen. You know, I think that we have too many really great members here that, you know, don't always get the opportunities that they should. And, you know, I would like to see that change.
Wow. Well, her name is going to be circled in red ink on Nancy Pelosi's desk because Nancy Pelosi, whatever else she has as skills, has a long memory against people that don't support her. Joe Crowley is a Democrat from New York who still supports Nancy Pelosi. And he was asked by Katie Turr on MSNBC what he thinks of calls for different Democratic leadership following the next election.
You know, Katie, I've heard that argument used so many times before, and I think it really reflects the sexism that still exists in politics today. I think Nancy Pelosi is held to a different standard than others are. The vilification of her in a very sexist way, quite frankly, is what's led to this discussion.
Yes, that sexist Linda Sanchez, who, when she plays in the congressional baseball game, Jim, literally wears a jersey, and her number is the Roman numeral 9 for Title IX. It's obvious from her career that it's because Nancy Pelosi is a woman that she should no longer be leader.
When a particular member of the party is in just about every attack ad put out by the other side, that should be a kind of a warning to you. That's a sign that this person is fairly unpopular, that the other side thinks they can really get some mileage by running against them. Now, I'm kind of looking back and I'm trying to think about whether there have been previous people who have been House speakers, lost the majority, and then not retired or kind of, you know, ridden off into the sunset. Pelosi, as we know, was House Speaker from 2007 to 2011. Did Hastert retire after 2006?
Well, he ran that year because he was obviously hoping to stay as speaker, but he resigned fairly soon after that once the new Congress started. Yeah,
Foley, right? Foley actually was defeated in the wipeout of 1994. Going back, James Wright, there was a scandal, Tip O'Neill. You go down the list. I mean, by and large, if you lose the majority, you kind of fall on your sword. You go down with your ship and you retire. Pelosi has not done that. And several cycles since then, 2012, 2014, 2016, Democrats have told themselves, oh, we're going to win back the House this year, right? And you probably would have said, you know, okay, well, if Obama's winning re-election by a fairly comfortable margin in 2012, they should have a decent shot at winning the House, and they didn't. And they did not do so in 2014. In fact, they had even, you know, it was an even worse midterm election for Democrats. And then following that, you know, 2016, they thought they were going to ride Hillary Clinton and the wave of women back to the majority, and that didn't turn out either. And you can say some of this is a result of gerrymandering and things like that. But really, if I'm a Democrat, I get the appeal of Obama. I kind of get the appeal of Joe Biden. Schumer, I think, is more of an acquired taste. But Pelosi, I mean, all she does is she basically, you know, generates gaffes. I know she's very good at fundraising. And I know she's been there a long time, which means she knows where all the bodies are buried. But it's just the idea that, you know, you might be better off with somebody who is not literally a San Francisco liberal who lives on Billionaire's Row. If Nancy Pelosi did not exist, House Republicans would have to, like, create her to be the living embodiment of everything they can't stand. The steadfast refusal of House Democrats to recognize this is probably one of the biggest advantages House Republicans have right now.
Well, good to see that there will be fighting. Hopefully it won't be because they have a majority that they squabble over their leadership. Hopefully they're still fighting over who's going to be minority leader come the fall, late fall, after the midterm elections next year. Jim, let's move on to our bad martini. And we talked about the hypocrisy of Tim Murphy. Let's talk about the hypocrisy of radical feminists now. The big story out of Hollywood yesterday was this bombshell report from the, and I know Wolf Blitzer has a copyright on that from all the Russia developments, but it is a bombshell story from the New York Times about Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. A couple different snippets from the story here. 2 decades ago, the Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein invited Ashley Judd to the Peninsula Beverly Hills Hotel for what the young actress expected to be a business breakfast meeting. Instead, he had her sent up to his room where he appeared in a bathrobe and asked if he could give her a massage or she could watch him shower, she recalled in an interview. Later on in 2014, Mr. Weinstein invited Emily Nester, who had worked just one day as a temporary employee, to the same hotel and made another offer. If she accepted his sexual advances, he would boost her career, according to accounts she provided to colleagues who then sent them to Weinstein Company executives. The following year, once again at the Peninsula, a female assistant said Mr. Weinstein badgered her into giving him a massage while he was naked, leaving her crying and very distraught. And there's 30 years of this. There's 8 actual settlements involved. People who work for Weinstein had to literally get him out of bed, do turndown duty, and many of them were repeatedly asked for a massage, and he could apparently switch on a moment's notice from actual work conversation to intimate conversation. So yesterday, the Times reveals all this. He has a statement which says, yeah, you know, I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior in workplaces were different. That was the culture then. It's no excuse. I've now asked Lisa Bloom to tutor me, and she's put together a team of people. And he pathetically says now he's now going to turn his attention to the NRA. Lisa Bloom, who, of course, is the daughter of Gloria Allred. Both of them have made careers now out of piling up accusers, some of them legit, some of them probably not, against famous people. Bill Cosby to Bill O'Reilly to Trump and all sorts of other people. Lisa Bloom, you think, would bury him on this, right? No. As a women's rights advocate, I've been blunt with Harvey, and he has listened to me. I've told him the times have changed. It's 2017, and he needs to evolve to a higher standard. I have found Harvey to be refreshingly candid and receptive to my message. He has acknowledged mistakes he has made. He is reading books, and he's going to therapy. He's an old dinosaur learning new ways. And so she goes on and on. And Jim, obviously, if this had been somebody who wasn't deeply intertwined with the Democratic world, the response from the left would be far harsh. And most of it's been silenced. Nothing from the late night hosts or anything else.
You go through the archives, you find headlines like Stephen Colbert and Harvey Weinstein send off film exec Daniel Batsek in style. Well, look, if everybody's buddies with Harvey Weinstein, all of a sudden nobody's going to want to, you know, everyone's just going to avert their eyes from this, you know, fairly glaring story. So first of all, we should give credit to the New York Times for doing the legwork on this story. Although apparently this is decades of behavior, and these stories have been floating around Hollywood for many, many years. And one of the things I'm kind of struck by, Greg, I mean, does your boss ask you to give you a massage very often?
No.
and I'm going to guess that almost all of your interactions with your boss are fully clothed. Am I correct?
All of them, 100%.
That's kind of standard operating procedure here at National Review. We really don't have that many naked meetings. And on the other hand, you know, there's always been this image of Hollywood, right? That, you know, Hollywood is this bacchanalian land of excess and fantasy land and, you know, the land of the casting couch. Hey, this happened, you know. That there's always been this not so hidden sleazy underbelly of Hollywood. And the idea that, look, you give some people enough money and power and the ability to make TV shows and movies happen, people will excuse a lot of terrible behavior. The fact that Gloria Allred is suddenly saying, look, this is not that bad. Look, they're also working on a television show or movie together. Right? I mean, this is basically like, look, the person who is financing my dream project is the finest human being I know. And all of these requests for naked massages are just complete misunderstandings. He's an old-fashioned guy. Now, I mean, what's kind of fascinating is how much you aren't seeing every baby boomer, everybody who came of age in the 60s and 70s saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Somehow I managed to go. I was in that same environment. And somehow I managed to not request people give me naked massages. There's something kind of amusing about how over the top Weinstein's defense is to say these multiple notes of, look, I'm an old fashioned guy. I do stuff like that, like request actresses give me naked massages. This is something that they used to do in the good old days, you know, the Pepperidge Farm or whatever. We all remember the Norman Rockwell painting of the boss requesting a naked massage from the secretary, right? So really, he's got these old-fashioned values, and he's just not up with the kids these days and their wacky ideas that this is wrong. But then he goes into this idea of, well, he's also going to sue the New York Times, right? He's apologized for the misunderstandings and what he's done, but all of it's untrue. There's lots of allegations that are not true. He's going to sue the newspaper, which is, you know, remember we make fun of Trump for doing that. But then the third thing is it's all the NRA's fault. He's going to take it out on the NRA. It's kind of like, hey, liberals, I'm one of you. OK, remember that. And you're seeing some folks make the very fair observation here. People are comparing this to the allegations against Roger Ailes, the allegations against Bill O'Reilly. I don't know if you could say, oh, you know, everyone turned a blind eye to Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly because they were conservative. You could definitely say they turned a blind eye because they were powerful. When the accusations came out against them, I don't remember Bill O'Reilly saying, defend me because I'm conservative. And many of us would not have, because we're not so sure he is that conservative. We think he's kind of this barstool philosopher who just bellows and, you know, makes fun of Mary Catherine Hamm and is generally that kind of guy. But the fact that Weinstein is so much saying, look, I'm one of you, right? I'm one of you liberals. I can't be this way. You got to give me a pass on this. Now, look, he's been a huge fundraiser for the Clintons for all these years. He's been a huge fundraiser for Democrats in general, huge fundraiser for the Obamas. Now, it's interesting to note here, one of the Obama daughters went to work for his film company. It was an internship or a paid gig or something like that. Greg, for all of our criticism of President Obama, and there's been plenty, and we criticized Michelle Obama earlier this week, let's point out, I think if you send your daughter to work for the guy, it's a pretty good sign you don't know about these allegations. Probably some Democrats did not. You're hearing a couple of Democratic lawmakers have already said they're going to take the amount of money that Weinstein donated to them over the years, the equivalent of that, and donate that to charity because they don't want to be seen as being profiting from, if not blood money, let's just call it sleazy money. And it is kind of fun to watch the Democrats panicking over this and how many Democrats, like if Jimmy Kimmel can talk about gun control for so long and healthcare for so long, suddenly we've had a topic that Jimmy Kimmel doesn't want to talk about at all. And it's worth noting that, you know, when a good portion of late night shows have become straight up talking points from the Democratic National Committee, it is unsurprising that a lot of us don't want to hear life lessons from Hollywood. Right. We don't think of Hollywood as being particularly good people. They may be funny. They may be charming. They may be very good at pretending to be someone else. But we don't really think of them as role models. And we know that they've been operating in this very protected bubble in which appearances count for a lot. Power counts for a lot. You're basically, you know, if you're rich enough and you're wealthy enough, you can get away with a whole lot. Drug abuse is kind of, you know, ignored. Self-destructive behavior is ignored. And I don't think it's, you know, outrageous to say many, many women are objectified and treated very badly by very powerful men. This is why the Oscars are found to be insufferably self-congratulatory and smug and insufferable. So anyway, that's my rant on that. But the good thing is things are getting a lot better on late night television, right? Right, Greg?
Yes, yes. Just to show you, you know, 20 years ago, they were relentless on Bill Clinton. But now I think we've gotten to the point where they actually pick and choose based on politics who might be involved in who they're willing to poke fun at. But let's talk about late night TV, because the one late night host that we didn't talk about in terms of their ongoing rants about gun control was Jimmy Fallon. He mentioned the Las Vegas tragedy, had an opening song with Miley Cyrus and Adam Sandler. Not sure how that combination came together, but nonetheless, what we're going to be talking about today is when he had Hillary Clinton on the show earlier this week. And if you're familiar with Jimmy Fallon, you know every once in a while he does the thank you note thing where he pretends he's writing thank you cards, and they're usually pretty funny. This time he has the females on his staff write thank you cards to Hillary Clinton while she's sitting right there. And so there were several of them. We're going to play two of them, and then Miley Cyrus came out and did one herself. So here's what they sounded like.
for always sticking to the issues, even as people criticized you for superficial things like your hair, your wardrobe, and your appearance. You showed girls everywhere that politics isn't a popularity contest, because if it were, you would have won by about 3 million votes.
Yeah. Thank you, Hillary Clinton. I was with her. I'm still with her. And right now, I literally am with her.
Thank you, Hillary, for being a constant beacon of strength, hope, and determination for me and millions of other young women. You've been a role model and an inspiration and a voice of reason in uncertain times. I could go on and on, but I'd like to get right to the point. Can I give you a hug?
So, Jim, forget the puzzling phrases like somehow she's handled this election result with class and poise and so forth when she's blamed everyone else under the sun. But what do you make of the virtual genuflecting here before Hillary Clinton on late night TV?
Greg, I suppose we should give some credit. This is the funniest thing that Jimmy Fallon's show has done in many years. Maybe not intentionally, but it is very funny. The other thing is also, I mean, how'd you like to be Hillary Clinton and have Miley Cyrus in front of you saying, Hillary Clinton, you're the reason I am the woman I am today. Yay? Really? Is that? I don't remember Michael Dukakis getting this treatment, Greg. I don't remember Walter Mondale or Bob Dole actually kind of went around. And there was kind of this strange phenomenon of losing presidential candidates, particularly with, you know, I remember George H.W. Bush did a little kind of taped appearance when Dana Carvey came back to host Saturday Night Live. Bob Dole started doing commercials. Gore started teaching that if you lost a presidential race, you generally there was a certain amount of softening of the attitude. Like the people who had voted against you so vehemently ended up not disliking you so much because you were no longer a threat to be elected. Like that once you became this post-political figure, there was a certain amount of warming up to you. And I don't see that happening for Hillary. And what's really intriguing is my suspicion is, look, obviously Trump voters and Republicans hate her, but I figured a certain number of Democrats really are angry at her or would be lingeringly angry at her forever for losing what should have been the easiest slam dunk election of all time. That for whatever flaws Hillary had and for whatever less than sterling record the Obama administration had left, Donald Trump was, at least on paper, an exceptionally beatable Republican nominee. I mean, this guy was a constant controversy magnet. Half his party couldn't stand him. You know, the Electoral College, the blue wall, all these different things that should have been made victory, not just workable for Hillary Clinton, fairly easy compared to historical standards. And she fumbled and she dropped the ball. And you know, this is going to be, you know, the first line in her obituary for the rest of her life. Well, I guess it's not the first line of her obituary for the rest of her life. So we've seen late night comedy react to this development in a very strange and uncharacteristic way, in which they pretty much abandon any pretense of pursuing comedy or satire or finding something ironic in the developments here. There was Saturday Night Live the week after the election. I remember watching in Florida, just wondering what they were going to do. And Kate McKinnon comes out as Hillary Clinton and plays a song. And I keep waiting for the punchline. There's no joke. Then they did a sketch about saluting President Obama right before Inauguration Day, which was, again, no punchline, unless it's like really subtle. This is what the show would be like if we were in North Korea, you know, hooray for dear leader type stuff. And now we see this from Jimmy Fallon. And I think it's really interesting that like the job of political comedy or late night comedy. First of all, late night comedy shows used to be not that political. Jay Leno used to be considered fairly political, and this is, you know, early Jay Leno, like 80s, early 90s Jay Leno, not, you know, later on. In the political in the sense that, like, it helped to have read the newspaper to know what he was joking about. Year by year, late night comedy became steadily more left, and now something has happened, the election of Trump, that the average progressive liberal cannot find anything funny about. There is nothing worth laughing. Never mind the fact that this feels like the most absurd twist in U.S. history. There's nothing funny about it. There's nothing happy about it. There's no room for levity. There's no room for laughter. And that you, if you're in late night comedy, you have to be every bit as outraged as they are. And I don't think that righteous indignation and comedy, either they don't mix well or they're not mixing well in this case. So you're seeing certain shows abandon the pretense of even pretending to be comedy. I think it's a good way of describing the way Jimmy Kimmel has become. Now, I'm sure Jimmy Kimmel feels like he's getting a lot of attention for this. I don't know whether the ratings are up. But he's, you know, comedy is getting more relevant, and I'm making air quotes as I say that, as it gets less, and I'm not making air quotes as I say this, funny.
Well, that's certainly the case, but he's become the conscience of the nation now. That's what CNN tells us and a couple other.
Once you're called that, why would he go back to, you know, doing Americans Are So Fat jokes?
Oh, and he keeps telling us that's not what he wants to talk about. But I guarantee you it's his best ratings talking about this stuff. So we'll see. Jim, have a good weekend. Good luck to the Jets. Good luck to the Bears. Good luck to the Michigan Wolverines. Have a good weekend. Talk to you Tuesday, actually.
See you Tuesday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us. David French and I will be here on Monday, and Jim will be back on Tuesday. Have a great Columbus Day weekend, everyone.